Hello, this is Chris.
And I'm Angie.
We just wanted to provide a quick update for this episode. We recorded the Vaquita Porpoise and River Dolphin episode in late October. And then a week later, the conservation story that we tell you over the next hour, we talk a lot about how they are working in the Gulf of California to save this species, the Vaquita Porpoise specifically.
Right. The species went from a population of 60 2 years ago down to 30 this year.
Right.
And so many conservationists and scientists internationally decided they need to take matters into their own hands,
right,
for sure, to try to help save the Vaquita Porpoise.
Right.
And so their goal was to use ocean pens to capture, or at least attempt to capture, the remaining 30 in an attempt to save them.
My friend Jonathan, who's at the UF Vet School, knows some people on that project, and he talked a little bit about that and what's going on with them and how devastated people are. Long story short, they captured a female, they brought her into one of these ocean pens, and she died. She stressed out and died, and this is why porpoises aren't good in captivity. So I just want to let you know we are aware. They've completely shut the project down for now. They may reattempt in the spring, in a few months, but they're trying to evaluate what they're doing, and I think we may just be witnessing the end of this population. They just may end up going extinct.
Yeah, it's sad.
Yeah.
Is my hope, though, is maybe there will be a miracle.
Yeah.
You never know. Or that at least the worst case scenario is that as researchers and scientists and conservationists, we can learn from some of the issues that have happened with Vaquita, which you'll hear more about in the episode.
Right.
If we can learn from that and do better, because there's lots of other species out there that need our help.
Right. And, you know, they're not out yet, but may be. They may be. So listen, you know, learn their great species and share.
Sure. And
you
we
know,
touch
with people that you know.
Yeah. We touch on the river dolphins too, which a lot of those species are having some issues. And so you're going to learn a lot of interesting facts
yeah,
and hopefully fall in love with the pink river dolphin and also the Vaquita.
So just keep following us on our website, allcreaturespod.com, and we'll keep you updated on what we know about the Vaquita, and enjoy the episode.
Thank you.
Over 7 million different animals inhabit our planet.
Okay, so, the river dolphin, the Vaquita. Let's talk about cetaceans today.
Yes, this is a really cool group of aquatic mammals.
What can they teach us?
Each female, this is great, Chris. It's been documented that females have different mothering styles.
Hmm.
Okay, some are very protective.
Yeah.
While some are more relaxed and letting their calves explore.
Many species are in crisis and need your help.
From what they can tell, the counts in 2016 alone were cut in half. So
right.
There was about 60, now there's about 30.
Right.
Basically, earlier this year in 2017, the Mexican government, bless their hearts.
Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.
Welcome to the All Creatures Podcast. I'm Chris.
And I'm Angie.
Angie, I'm fired up.
Uh-oh.
I'm really fired. I'm in a good way.
Should I put a seatbelt on you?
Yes,
or?
Please. I am really fired up this morning. And I really wanted to record last night, but I knew I need to sleep on my thoughts.
You should always give it a good 12-hour grace period.
So, yesterday afternoon, I sat in on a seminar. Our good friend Charlotte, she gave a great seminar on the Earth's sixth mass extinction to a group of scientists. Of all people. So it was really a group that needs to hear this. You know, a lot of animal scientists, and I'd say a lot of them were
physiologists.
Related, right. Yeah. Livestock, you know, kind of those folks. The room was probably half to three quarters South American scientists.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like they really needed to get this message because that is obviously a hot spot. Because today we're going to talk about the Vaquita porpoise and river dolphins, which both are Central and South America, and then the river dolphins in Asia. But again, a hotspot. You know, we talk about conservation hotspot.
Sure, there's a lot of wildlife ecological diversity in the Amazon basin, for sure.
Right. Charlotte did an awesome job presenting the evidence and the data. And then we had a really good, I'd say 20, 30 minute discussion. And to back up a little bit, in science, as scientists, debate is good.
Debate is normal and healthy.
That's what we do, right? We debate about a lot of stuff. And then we come to consensus.
Right. We look at the facts.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes feelings get a little bit involved.
They do.
But we try to use facts.
Right. And we try to be logical in our arguments. So
in evidence.
In evidence. Right. Evidence-based arguments is everything that we're taught as scientists. And so, like, when you hear a little bit of debate in climate change, that's good and healthy. But when 90% of climate scientists come in and say, hey, this is a problem, this is an issue, you got to take notice. And that is pretty much a consensus.
Correct.
You know, and it was like renaming Pluto to a small planet or whatever that made the news.
Right. It hurt a lot of our feelings because we grew up with Pluto. Yeah. But the data kept showing time and time and time again that it was not a true full planet.
Yeah. And I don't even know what the consensus was. It was a majority, but it wasn't an overwhelming majority to rename Pluto as a planetoid or whatever. So we had a very good discussion on this yesterday, and I was very interested. You know, I'm taking notes furiously. But it got a little, I wouldn't say heated, but a little emotional, because there's a scientist in that room that I respect very well. I have followed his work for 20 years. I look up to him as a mentor, and he is very, very intelligent, very well respected around the world, probably one of the top reproductive scientists in the world. Long story short, he was talking about, first, he thinks humans will survive just fine in this sixth mass extinction. He's like, we're part of the nature, we're part of the environment, we will survive no matter what. And I disagree with that statement, because one of the things, and we didn't have time to get into all of this, and it's probably something that, like, we should go, you know, after work and sit around a table.
Sure, have a beer or coffee.
Yeah, and talk about these ideas, because that's what we like to do as geeks.
Totally what we love to do.
But, you know, the reason I think that's a wrong view to take as far as humans is, not only are we interrupting the circle of life and the tree of life, as resources start to become limited. You know, I brought up the point, like, desertification is a known phenomenon in parts of Africa.
Well, how are we going to feed this planet? How are we going to feed the people? And then there's disease, and we're obviously focusing on this podcast on wildlife, but I don't think people are not susceptible to some extinction possibilities too, or at least suffering.
Right.
And there's already a lot of human suffering.
Right. And as the population grows, and that's what his bottom line was, we have too many people, which I agree with.
Of course. I think
we all agree with that. And that's why we're straining the resources. And one of the things that Charlotte said yesterday, which I hadn't heard before, but it was a great factoid, was we're using about 1.6 of the Earth's resources at the rate right now. So we need we almost need two Earths to support what we're using.
What we're taking out.
And what we're taking out to be sustainable. So his first point about humans will survive just fine, I disagree with, because I think as resources get limited, our military here in the United States, they have identified climate change as a major threat. Mm-hmm. And the question is why? Why would the military, you know, even though our government doesn't, or some political leaders in our country don't see it as a threat, when the U.S. military says this is a huge threat to our country?
Well, yeah, I think just today, the government stated an issue backing up climate change.
Right.
Now, of course, that probably doesn't represent certain people in the government.
Like our wonderful EPA head right now is just a joke.
The consensus is they are moving forward, even probably with the heads that are being butted against. They're still saying, no.
Right.
This is an issue.
Right. And I don't want to turn this particular podcast into a political discussion.
Are you sure?
I know. No. I don't. And I think, you know, once we start doing the weekly...
Because I don't know if I've had enough coffee for that, Chris, to be honest. No.
Just... And I know you and I want, you know, maybe by the time this one launches that we'll have our weekly kind of news show.
Sure.
Just us talking politics and stuff about conservation and the stuff with that. We'll stick this to, because we do want to get to the river dolphins and the vaquitas.
Yes. But their behavior is amazing.
It is. So just quickly, you know, when the U.S. military sees it as a threat, I see it as resources get limited, humans are going to fight for it, right?
That's a big thing. It's already happening.
The second thing that really got me fired up, and this one is where I really spoke up, was the scientist stated that he didn't feel we had a moral obligation to save endangered species. He says, I want to, personally, sure. I want to, but he thinks as a species, we don't have a moral obligation. And that's what got me fired up, because I was like, how do you, you know, and I used elephants, obviously, as my example. And I said, how do you reason with an animal that's taken 50 million years to evolve to where they are today and wipe them out in 100?
Right.
How do we not have as a moral obligation with our intelligence.
Well, I was gonna say, we claim intelligence and emotion and all of these, this greatness. Right. To not use that greatness and that intelligence to help animals.
Right.
And it's one thing to maybe not help them, but we're destroying them.
Right. It's our fault. It's correct. Our, it's not a natural. I mean,
no, it's not
I
natural.
Guess his view is it is natural because we are part of the natural environment.
Right, because we're dominant.
Destroy it. Mm-hmm. And my bottom line is, yeah, the Earth's going to survive.
Of
the
course.
Earth will survive.
Yes.
It's survived 5 mass extinctions. It will survive the 6th. And when there's a 7th and an 8th and a 9th, then something else will replace it. It's just, will we survive as a species, Homo sapiens? And I don't think we will continue at this rate.
Right. And is that the history you want to leave behind?
Exactly.
When you're a conscious, cognitive being.
I had to get that off my chest because I was so fired up about it. And I
good
was,
morning, listeners.
I know. I was about to like call you on the phone and say, tomorrow we're going to da da da. And then I was like, no, just hold off. And then just deal with my kids last night. So busy. The Vaquita and river dolphins.
Yes. So, Chris, what are we talking about today?
That's an important issue.
It is.
And that's what we, you know, and this is the point of our podcast, is to get people working together, develop this community of learners that we like to say in education, and this community of activists.
And I think it's important for, we always talk about in academia, we always continue our education too. It doesn't stop one day, just when you graduate. It doesn't stop once you start teaching. It's always evolving, and talks like this help us stay fired up and stay sharp and keep fighting and thinking critical too.
Right.
Like, because I guess the way that I always think about these things is like, wow, how could I sit down with that gentleman and get him to see my points or change his mind, or maybe he'll change my mind. I don't know, but that's when you're a critical thinker, it can be fun.
It is. It's challenging and
frustrating.
It is frustrating because you're like, you want to strangle people. Not him. I mean, I love him. But certain people, you know, it was like, anyways, politics. Okay. So the river dolphin, the vaquita. Let's talk about cetaceans today.
Yes. This is a really cool group of aquatic mammals.
Mm-hmm. And you missed it. I said it correctly.
You did.
Cetaceans. It's a big word for me.
It is a big word. It is. But yeah, so it's the whales, dolphins, and porpoises.
Right. That's the group.
But today we wanted to focus on the river dolphin and mostly. And then there's some freshwater species and then some that go both fresh and salt water. Right. But then the vaquita is an oceanic.
Yeah, porpoise.
Porpoise. So a little bit of the yin and the yang today.
Right, and it's kind of, you know, because you and I, when we decided to do two, because I know we're trying to focus on one species and we've been talking about others that are related, but you were like, should we just focus on one dolphin or two or what, whale? And, like, you know, let's just do this. This is, and I think this gives us a good comparison of not only marine mammals versus a freshwater mammal, which is completely unique.
Correct.
And then it gives us a difference between porpoises and dolphins. What's the difference there? So I think this is a fun thing to talk about. It was fun to research.
And it was. And I think the underlying bottom line, though, is that both of these groups of mammals are in peril.
Right. Yeah, very much so. And the vaquita, I think the reason we wanted to focus on that, and there's not a lot known about them. You know, we're going to cover as much as we can. But there's only 30 left.
Right.
So again, a critical endangered species. That's why we're highlighting
them.
Let's
repeat that. There are only 30 left.
Yeah, that we know of. That it could be less than that. Could be more, but they're in a pretty concentrated area in the Gulf of California.
Well, and they're being highly watched. They've been trying to either increase numbers or not decrease numbers really critically for 5 years.
Right.
And the Mexican government has been working with international scientists, especially in the States and South America, trying to figure out how to help these guys and implementing.
You really got to applaud the Mexican government too.
Absolutely.
For the steps they have taken. They have really stepped
in. They hit the ground running and hit it really hard. And
so kudos to them.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And are smart enough to see within 1 year, you know, within one year they were losing this battle, and so now they're calling in all the troops.
Right, and it's a global effort.
It's definitely a global effort to help save these guys, and so it's hopefully going to be a feel good story.
Right.
In ten years from now.
Yeah, in the end, the river dolphins are just, I think, an amazing group to study too, because you have river dolphins in the Amazon, which is, you know, very remote region on Earth, and they estimate there's maybe 13,000 population, which is pretty big and healthy. You know, yeah, doing okay. Bad. They're doing okay. They're vulnerable, mm-hmm. but they're doing okay. Then you have the Indian or Ganges river dolphin, which is not doing as well.
No.
Yeah, they're classified as endangered, and there's about 2,000 to 3,000 of them.
And left. They and there's lots of reasons for mm-hmm. that, but they live in a very populous.
Very. India is like, I don't even know if it's surpassed China yet, but Indian population has boomed over the last couple decades. Now, the sad story of today, you know, play some sad music, which is very sad, is the Chinese or Yangtze river dolphin is classified as extinct.
Functionally extinct.
Yes. Or the Bali. I think it's the Bahli dolphin is extinct. I did see a report earlier this year that they might have sighted some of small pod in the very remote regions. But again, that hasn't been confirmed. So they pretty much assume that they're extinct. So a species that's long gone. Now the vaquita,
right. This is the ocean porpoise. Right.
The porpoise in the Gulf of California. What has knocked them down is they weren't being purposely hunted or poached, but fishermen in the area using gill nets have caught these porpoises and they've drowned. So that is what really has decimated the population. And what the Mexican government has done is they first restricted gillnet use, then they just outright banned it a couple years
ago. They, yeah, like I mentioned earlier, they really stepped up to the plate. Right. They tried something as far as restricting it that wasn't working. Mm-hmm. And quickly they just, you know, put the hammer down and said, no more
gillnets. Mm-hmm. And it's illegal. But, good old human beings, there has been a lot of poaching because the poachers are going after this fish called the totoboa.
Totoboa, yeah.
Totoboa. And their bladders can fetch $20,000 per bladder on the black market for Chinese herbal medicine. So here we go again. So consequently, these fishermen are out there using gill nets to catch these fish, and the porpoises are still getting caught. And
right,
dying.
They're kind of the byproduct.
Right. So that is why it's still a fight. It's still a big fight down that region of the world. So the river dolphins, what their pressures are, and I'm sure we'll get a little bit more into this, is obviously, is again, a similar theme. Habitat fragmentation, damming up rivers. So really the Yangtze River dolphin, what drove them to extinction was dams.
Sure. So then, fragmenting their population, right, restricting it.
Where they couldn't go. Then, you know, again, we talked about genetic diversity last episode. So you get less genetic diversity, less survival in the wild.
Less food sources. Mm-hmm.
And then pollution. Pollution's been a big one. That is what wiped out a lot of them in China.
Well, and I think it brings to an interesting point of these river dolphins, especially ones that are in some of the freshwater systems, mm-hmm. is they're really indicators as far as pollution goes, of river health.
Right. Yeah.
And so if their overall state of health is bad and not flourishing, it's also kind of trickle down, right, downhill to other animal, other
species,
marine, right, other fish species. And then the people that eat those, the locals that need those. And a lot of these communities, there's mining with mercury pollution, mm-hmm. and some organochlorides, and right, there's different things that they're struggling against.
So the river ecosystems are really messed up.
Yes, and definitely in certain parts.
Let me go back to my friendly scientist yesterday and say, look at this. Not only do we have this great garbage patch in the Pacific.
I wish the listeners could see your face
right
now.
Oh my God, but it's like, look at the rivers.
No, I know.
They're dying.
The planet. They're dying.
It's amazing to me because I think it's not only selfish as a species, but it's very narrow-minded that I don't see how it's not going to have an effect on Homo sapiens. I just don't.
Right.
So I'm scared for migration.
It is. I mean, yeah. it is having effect on
it
people
is. It
already.
Is. You're right. You're right. It is. It is. That's very, very true. So you're right. So that's a great bioindicator species. I mean, that was the next thing I was going to talk about. So water quality is really, and quantity,
yes,
is down. And climate change is having an effect, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, and maybe when we really get into another marine species, we'll talk a little bit about acidification. Like the corals, that's what's really devastating coral reefs, is the oceans getting more acidic.
Right.
As the planet warms up, as the ice shelves and all those things, fresh water gets more dumped in the ocean, blah, blah, blah. You get more acidification, so that's having a negative effect on that.
So when you're in New Zealand, you're going to go see the Great Barrier Reef before it's gone?
I know.
It's already partially gone,
yeah,
right?
It's already partially gone, and luckily, I dove the Barrier Reef like 15 years ago when I was in Australia.
Wow, but, cool.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
I'm going to go see the last little piece of it and take a picture. You know, it's really horrible that's going on. One thing I think we should kind of get early on too is, what's the difference between a dolphin and a porpoise? We did this with frogs and toads.
And learned a little
bit. Toads pee on you. So we know that. So if you haven't heard that episode, please go listen to that episode. The differences between dolphins and porpoises. So it was a little interesting to kind of do some research. I knew a little bit different. So.
I had no idea. Mm-hmm. I didn't know if it was terminology or where they lived. It was really interesting to find out that there really isn't a huge difference.
No, not a lot.
It's like basically, you know, animal dorks and we're not in more like, us. Is it? That is us. But like zoologists and the people that name the different
species
that have very, very fine categories of what separates a dolphin versus a porpoise. Right. So somebody with a trained eye might not necessarily even know visually by just looking at them.
Yeah, one of the things I was very surprised about porpoises, I thought they were as numerous as dolphins. And there's only 6 species of porpoise.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And like
okay.
over 30 species of dolphins. Right. So very few porpoises compared to dolphins. Porpoises, and we'll get this with the vaquita, maybe when we get to the conservation efforts, don't stay in captivity, or there's been some research on them, a couple captive populations, but they tend to die in captivity. They don't do well. They get stressed very easily. The dolphins have longer beaks.
It's longer.
So, you know, think of Flipper, which is, I don't know if anybody knows who Flipper is anymore.
Wow, you just really dated yourself, Chris.
It was before I was born was when Flipper, but, it, you know, reruns.
No, I saw
movie
reruns
in like
too.
2000s? I don't know, Flipper. Yeah. So there was the dolphin. Long beaks. The dolphins have cone-shaped teeth, so porpoises have like a small mouth.
Mm-hmm. I believe it's the teeth is one of the biggest
things, right?
Biggest differences.
So porpoises have spade-shaped teeth. The fins, the dorsal fins, are a little bit different. Dolphins are skinnier.
Oh, I would not have guessed that.
So porpoises are a little portly. Portly porpoise.
Okay, that's a good way to remember
it. 100 times, And dolphins are more social, so I know you're excited to get to behavior, so we will definitely get there. I think we picked 2 great species to kind of talk the difference between porpoises and dolphins.
Sure.
And then freshwater versus, you know, the marine mammals.
Yeah, well, in the physiology dork in me was having a lot of fun researching, like, how can they
survive?
How can they survive in saltwater and or freshwater, and what is the differences? So it's pretty...
Yeah, it's almost like the bull shark. The one shark I don't like.
Oh.
I'm scared to death of bull sharks. Like great whites, if I saw a great white, I would just die of a heart attack right then and there. You know, I always wonder, because I grew up on the beaches of California.
Yeah.
I always wonder how many...
Did you surf?
Yeah. And I'm wondering how close I came to a great white in my life that I didn't know about.
Yeah.
You know?
But you have to remember, it's more scared of you than you
I know, are I know. And I'm not scared of sharks. Like the data... I just read something yesterday. Like the data... The United States has more shark attacks than anywhere else on Earth, but the death rate's like 0.6 people.
Yeah, I think you're way more likely to die from a kick of a cow
or
a bite from a dog.
Or bee sting or something. Yeah, so I mean, but bull sharks are just, they're just,
tough.
Yeah, and they go up rivers. So I'm like, I'm swimming and all of a sudden I see a dorsal fin, I'm going to die.
And so, but correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the ability to go from the freshwater to the salt or salt to fresh, a lot of it has to do with how they process the salt in their kidneys.
Right. I think so.
Differences in their kidneys of being able to deal with that high salinity basis.
Now, I will say, I am a child of the 70s, so Jaws has ruined me for sharks. I know Jaws has
done
more
I'm the same
harm.
Over here. Yeah. Yes, Jaws. I actually did a senior thesis in college on the... Basically, the negative impacts
that Jaws has had
on sharks. Pop media or whatnot on sharks.
Yeah, yeah. But I think Shark Week's been awesome, like dispelling some of that
I think
stuff.
In the past 20 years, there's been a bigger push to educate people.
Right.
Or I use a Shark Tracker, and I follow Mary and her, you know.
Is she the one that, the great white that's like off Florida? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's coming to
She
the
goes
Gulf.
From Florida to New England.
Right.
She's great.
So yeah, sharks are awesome. I mean, anyways, bull sharks have all the one. The vaquita... is in the Gulf of California, at the tip of... So really the tip of the Baja Peninsula and Mexico proper. So that was their habitat.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't really go outside of that.
Okay.
They didn't go out to
the
great big
waters.
Pacific Ocean. Right. Yeah, and they really stay in shallow water. This part of the the Gulf is pretty shallow, so they don't go into anything really deep. The river dolphins, kind of switching gears, going from ocean to river, wide, huge range, especially in Amazon. So they pretty much cover the entire Amazon River, up all the tributaries.
Lots of tributaries.
Yeah, it's a really cool species.
One of you... think about it from an evolutionary point, which I know you're dying to get into evolution.
Yeah, I'm almost there.
I'm almost there. But it's really interesting that most likely the oceanic dolphins went into the rivers to find new sources and, you know, evolved
food, right.
to live there and do well there, to find new food and get rid of the ocean competition.
Right.
And they probably for, you know, you know the numbers, but probably for tens of thousands of years, they did great.
Yeah.
And then now... in a matter of 100 years,
not
with the industrial revolution and the technological revolution, that they're not doing great.
Right.
And they have nowhere to go. At least in the ocean, I feel like they've seen behavioral patterns with a lot of the marine mammals where they kind of can move.
Or try to evade humans.
Evade humans and whatnot. But there's just not enough space in these rivers. And now, like you said, we're damming them up.
Right, right. Yeah, and it's, you know, the ones in South America, they're... there's a really cool population too that is above a waterfall. So there's a waterfall barrier.
Oh, okay.
So how many thousands of years has that species been isolated? Mm-hmm. So it's its own separate species.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't differ a lot physiology, but genetically it does. And they've been isolated above this waterfall in the Amazon. And I think you're right that, you know, they depend on the health of these rivers and this ecosystem. The other river dolphins in mainly India. So the Ganges River, the Indies River, there's some river dolphins. Again, ones that either go brackish water, which brackish water is both...
A mixture.
A mixture is that fresh water, you know, bleeds into the ocean, does that. And then obviously the Yangtze River dolphin was in China, but is no longer in existence. All right.
Okay.
Evolution. Here we go.
I see that smile on your face.
So it was cool, though. It was like, it's like
I have to admit, I didn't dive too much into evolution because I know that that's your baby. But the little bit that I did dive into, I knew there was a reason that my childhood fantasy was to work with dolphins.
Yeah.
Who wasn't, you know, who didn't want to either be a dolphin trainer or a marine biologist and study these guys? And then, of course, I ended up going more towards
hoofstock
ungulates, horses, zebras, things with hoofs and horns and whatnot. But looking at the evolution of the dolphins, it seems that I might just like that family in general.
I know. And I wonder why. Because you texted me. You're like, oh my God, did you know dolphins were related to?
To?
Hippos.
Hippos and cows and goats.
I was like, oh, I'm saving that to surprise you.
Well, and of course, you know, I tell this to my husband. He's like, oh, I knew that.
Yeah, I know.
He's a smart
dork.
Dude.
He's a greater dork than we are.
Yeah, for sure.
In a good way. In a good way. We love John. The cetacean evolution, you know, there's not a lot known specifically, you know, looking into this. It's difficult to study because, again, the marine mammals, a lot of their bones and stuff are in deep oceans. Yeah. So you're not going to find them unlike the land.
Fossils.
Right. But they do find them on beaches and some parts of where we used to be underwater, like, say, here in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
We used to be underwater a long time ago. So they've done a lot of stuff, I would say specifically... the porpoises are more related to narwhals and belugas.
Okay.
Which kind of makes sense, right?
Yeah.
They're kind of, you know, those colder. And then obviously oceanic dolphins.
Right.
So they're pretty related. You really got to kind of go out 10, 15 million years ago where the river dolphins split off. And then they're kind of
That long ago?
Yeah. So about 10, 15 million years ago as the oceans receded off the land mass. Now, if we go way back where this all began, again, that big, huge, after the fifth mass extinction, pretty similar, 45, 50 million years ago, big explosion. And basically, you said an ungulate, a two-toed, so our cows, our camels, those types of animals, giraffes, one of them decided to just go swimming one day and said, hey, this looks fun. And they went in the water.
And they liked it.
And they liked it, and they stayed.
And they were successful there.
Yes, and they... so over 50 million years.
Well, or if you think of like a hippo kind of is...
in between.
Right, semi-aquatic.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a mammal, right? So it's a mammal that likes land, that comes out of land, but basically spends most of their life in water.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they want to be. This all happened in Asia, around India. So that's kind of where these guys arose.
Okay.
So the cetaceans, long time ago. And again, the reason we can link it back to these even-toed ungulates, DNA, you know, our favorite thing, DNA, tells a story.
Maternal mitochondria.
Yeah, that's what we've done.
Now let's fast forward to today. The local people are wanting to help save these guys, right, for the most part, and are doing a lot of ecotourism, mm-hmm, and learning that they can, you know, that's a good way for them to generate income, but mm-hmm, then also to help save these species. Mm-hmm. But with that being said, there was a recent op-ed piece out of New York Times that has some kind of a title along the lines of, I don't know, going to the Amazon. If you go to the Amazon, don't punch a dolphin, right, river dolphin.
Right.
And basically the brief history of that goes into the kind of conflict of ecotourism interacting too much with the wildlife.
Right.
And these tour guides offering, you know, for extra tips, you can, you know, feed the dolphins or maybe touch them or ride them and things like that, which...
It's almost like here in Florida, too, with the manatees. It's sure. It's a big deal that mm-hmm, you cannot touch the manatees. And we do have, you know, 45 minutes away, you know, Crystal River.
Where have we you live. Gone?
I've gone. We've awesome. Paddled by them.
Okay.
And I actually saw a cow and a calf, like, swim by
cool.
us.
Oh, yeah. We did the snorkeling, but absolutely no touching.
No touching. Yeah. You just kind of float around. Mm-hmm.
And they only allow a certain amount of people in per day. Time, and they right. only allow a certain amount of licensed operators that mm-hmm. are... I mean, you have to watch a video. Mm-hmm. They're, let alone pay a lot of money.
Right.
They're pretty serious about it. And that just goes to show that we have a lot of more regulations and probably been doing the ecotourism thing maybe
longer,
right. You know. And so I think it's one of these things I have full belief that this was probably, you know, there's rare incidents of people exploiting animals. Mm-hmm. And but that if you are ever a tourist on a, you know, in a foreign country or even here in the United States, mm-hmm. you know, respect the rules, respect right. the wildlife. And the journalist that was writing this piece said that, you know, her favorite part of her Amazonian tour was actually just being in a canoe mm-hmm. and paddling down it with a tour guide,
right.
like not touch, not nature, feeding right. the animals, because once again, if we feed the feeding these dolphins, then they become dependent on that mm-hmm. food, and it's a whole trickle down effect of other problems right. of a lot of they've noticed a lot of unnatural behaviors mm-hmm. with these dolphins as far as aggression and things, mm-hmm. which normally they're extremely social animals, mm-hmm. except for maybe during breeding. So I think, you know, our future with them is that we, as far as with ecotourism, is we want to keep working with them, mm-hmm. but we got to make sure that we're not exploiting them right. too.
Both these species are, it's amazing to, you know, and I guess this is what's fun about, I guess, doing this podcast is we get to learn more and diversify. Because I in the last few episodes, we talked about, you know, how much you and I love land animals.
I feel like a little kid again. I'm learning yeah. so much. I mean, not to say that I'm not learning anything in my PhD, but it's a very strict, narrow
focus. Right. We're really broadening and, you know, thinking about, like you said, being a kid, like, oh, I want to be a dolphin trainer, marine biologist, because I was at, you know, grew up near Scripps Institute in La Jolla.
Very famous place.
Right. And it's like, oh, the oceans are amazing and I want to study the oceans. And then, oh, the zoos... Zoology is amazing. I want to go study animals in the wild. And, oh, I love medicine, animal medicine, and I want to study this. So at least we get to do a little bit of this and spread the knowledge, you know, to other animal lovers out there. The life cycle of these species is pretty interesting. The vaquita, again, we don't know a ton of them because...
Sure, they're only in the wild and there's not many of them left.
Right. But they do estimate they can live to maybe 20, 25 years in the wild. Some porpoise species live like 12, 13 years.
Oh, not very long.
Yeah, not very long. You would think longer because you hear about whales. Like, I think they have found a whale with like a harpoon from like the 1800s.
Wow.
Still stuck in them.
Wow. Like, or you think of turtles.
Right. 100 and something years that mm-hmm. it was pretty old. River dolphins, again, the data isn't clear, but they think Amazon ones roughly 15 years, even though they've had some in captivity that can live to be 30.
Okay.
And then the data I saw on the Ganges or the Chinese river dolphins was about 25 to 30 years that they live. So, you know, pretty good lives.
Long lives.
Now, the physical differences is easy to look at. Mm-hmm. And that's easy to talk about. Now, the vaquita, what's really cool about them is, and I even read a paper that talked about them being like small children. They're just small. They're very small.
Well, and that's why I think they get caught in the gill nets of these
fish.
Of the fish.
Right. And they... can get as long as 5 feet, but only weigh about 120 pounds.
Okay.
So about you. But you're
very
taller.
Flattering.
You're,
yes,
you're taller than 5 feet, though.
Whatever. I was just listening to 120.
55 kilograms, AD.
Now, this is why I work with him, folks.
Yeah, yeah.
He says on air that I weigh 120 pounds.
I always have a carrot in front of my grad students' faces to get them to graduate. Now, other porpoises are bigger. They're about my height, 6.5 feet, or I'm 6'5". So
kind of what we think of a dolphin size.
Right, 2 meters long, and then they can weigh like double the weight, like 265, which I don't weigh that much, but 118 kilograms. The vaquita has dark rings around its eyes, so they're really cool looking. And again, we'll put pictures on the show notes.
They're cute.
They are very cute. They're really cool. What I love about ocean animals too is, you know, sharks and penguins. I guess penguins is a good one to look at. And same thing with the vaquita, is their tops are dark, their bottoms are light, underside, and so really that's a strat. They've evolved to have these because prey, when they look up, you know, and the bright light and stuff of the ocean, they can't see a predator. Or when they look down, it's dark and they can't see a predator. So it's kind of cool. You see a lot of these species, even birds.
Evolution is just pretty genius.
It is. It is. It's so really cool. So they are. And they have like a lighter gray side. Now, the river dolphins, I'm going to sing the song, U-G-L-Y.
What?
No alibi. They're ugly. They are so hideous looking.
I mean, I think you're not looking at them with the same light that I am. They have pink in color. Maybe I'm not even a girly girl, so I'm not usually blinded by pink things. But it's so unique in their color, pinkish gray.
They are very unique. They're very unique.
And I think that's really beautiful, especially the Amazon is, or a lot of the rivers in the Amazon are, you know, brown, dark brown in color. So here's this beautiful, you know, pink highlights coming through the water.
I shouldn't call any animal ugly because I love them all. But
yeah, and I have to, I am, of course, biased. We're all biased. I had the great chance to see one in the wild.
Yeah.
And I didn't feed it, and I wasn't close to it. It just kind of like surfaced and did not even a jump, more of just a like probably
breach.
But to see that color, you know, we're out there looking for other things too, but to see that was just, it's one of those moments.
Yeah, you're like,
anybody
wow.
who's been, whale watching or dolphin watching and...
The cool thing about them is they're ancient. So if you want to know what like an ancient animal looks like, this is one that you can point to and say, this is what ancient mammals looked like. Because again, like scientists have said, this is an unnatural species. They shouldn't be here, but they are. You're right. The Amazon ones are pink, and that's due to their skin. When they're young, they're dark gray. Then they get lighter as they age, and then the adults are pink. And they think that in the Amazon, it's because of constant abrasions. So they lose some of those top layers of skin.
Interesting.
So that's why they're more pink. Don't see that coloration as much in the Ganges.
In the Asian Indian species.
Right. You don't see that as much. They're a little pink, but not as much as the Amazon. The Amazon pink river dolphins, also called the Boto, which I think you talked about. They're pig-eyed. So that's why I think they're kind of obscure. They have these really tiny eyes.
Right. And
which they really don't need it, right?
Right. They don't. I mean, they're not blind, but they have really poor vision.
Right, right. So it's like...
they don't need much vision because the water's so murky anyways.
Right. So it's not like they're really seeing. So they didn't evolve these large eyes to see because they don't need it. They really echolocate and do other things. Now, what's also interesting is the males are bigger than the females, which I read was rare in cetaceans.
It is sexual dimorphism, and that's, you know, looking at the sexes next to each other, you can tell them apart. Males are bigger, females are smaller. Right. And in a lot of the other cetaceans, we don't see that.
Right, yeah, so it's crazy. Now, what's also really cool about these guys is their fins are more like paddles compared to other dolphins, and they really are flexible. Because their vertebrae aren't as fixed.
Yeah, their necks. They can move their necks a lot more left and right.
Right. And they can turn in tighter circles. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the dolphins or porpoises in the ocean, their vertebrae are fixed where they're not as flexible. But these river dolphins really can move and bend around. Just you think about it, you know, it's such a tighter environment.
Sure. And when the rivers flood and they're probably going into the floodplains where there's trees and stuff, they have to bend around.
Right. And use that long snout. To find food. The Ganges, not a lot of difference. They're a little bit smaller. Their beaks, you know, I guess both beaks are kind of long and toothy is how you would do that. and not a whole big difference in their physiology.
Right. So, Chris, that kind of ties nicely into the next segment of river dolphin behavior. Mm-hmm. And we touched on the fact that they have poor vision, and they, like you said, they rely on echolocation or a sonar system to maneuver. But they do have a really well-developed hearing for both air and water.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, you know, pretty incredible, because I know, like, when I go underwater, I can barely hear. And interestingly enough, the Asian river dolphins, some of them tend to swim on their side with the flipper dragging along the bottom.
Wow.
And, of course, researchers don't know a lot about these guys, but they think that it might help them hunt and then also help them, you know, maneuver and not bump into things. Mm-hmm. Because they'll, of course, dolphins and porpoises breathe air. They're mammals. Mm-hmm. So they have to surface and get air. And so they go back to their normal, the normal way that we think about swimming, them, swimming to get the air. But then they come back down to their side and drag that side flipper. So once again, just different evolutionary behaviors to help them navigate their environment.
Right, right.
And they can, you know, they don't move as quick as dolphins and porpoises. They, one of the Asian species has been recorded traveling about 14 miles per hour. Or about how many kilometers?
Oh, geez. Don't even.
It's too early. I'll just give you the answer. About 23 kilometers per hour.
It's like gonna double it.
But I think what should really be highlighted, which I'm super excited to talk about in the dolphin behavior section of this podcast, is just in general a little bit about dolphin and porpoise intelligence. Like we said earlier, with both the vaquita and the river dolphin, especially the vaquita, there's not a lot we know because they haven't really been studied. And let's hopefully they live long enough so we can learn that they're very intelligent and learn more about them. And the river dolphin's been a little bit more studied. In fact, one of the Asian species has been compared to the intelligence of a gorilla.
Right. Right.
And so
they're up there with primates.
Oh, yeah. In fact, there's some scientists out there, and there's actually a recent conference of the American Association of Advancement of Science held by the publisher of Science, which Chris and I know would be an amazing, you know, place to publish our work. Right. It's the creme de la creme in science. But anyways, these guys all and girls all get together. And one of the topics was actually about, are dolphins as smart as people? And if they are, perhaps we should be treating them a little bit better.
Right.
So, you know, maybe the scientist that you were speaking at or of earlier in the podcast that said we didn't have a moral obligation to save species from this mass extinction, he probably would have benefited from, you know, going to this conference and hearing what these other scientists were saying, that they're probably the Earth's second smartest creature.
Right.
We don't have as much data of them as we do about perhaps like great apes and whatnot, because they're a little harder to study. They're harder to keep in captivity and whatnot. But what we do know is a lot from like the bottlenose dolphin. That's flipper. That's the typical one that we all think of. But that they have, their brain's actually bigger than ours. And they have a brain to body weight ratio of great apes, but a little bit smaller than humans. So one scientist said that they're the second most encephalized being on the planet. Right. So biggest brain for body. And, you know, they've been reported to recognize themselves in a mirror or self-awareness. They can understand complex gestures and or sentences from humans during training. They can learn to poke a keyboard underwater to request toys, which I have a 14-month-old at home, and Zachary, and that's the level he's at right now. And so, I mean, if you really sit and, you know, sit and think on that one for a minute, that these animals are thinking, feeling, and that doesn't necessarily mean that they're more worthy of being saved than, let's just say, a turtle or something. And so their intelligence, as far as what we know, is self-awareness, and some scientists have described them as rational as far as their decision-making. But we can even just look to their social structure, too, and see that it's also very advanced, which can be a sign of intelligence. For instance, females in a pod are usually spotted together, and they've been seen assisting with birth. And then also females can be babysitters and helping rear the dolphins. And one of the best ways a female dolphin can learn how to take care of a calf is to be in that setting.
Right.
And now on the flip side of it, the males become pair bonded. And this is a really cool story that was just reported, I don't know, a few months ago. So males pair bonded. They live in their own pods. There was a study of them off the coast of Australia, and I think of regular dolphins. Mm-hmm. But that one pod colluded with another pod, okay, different, non-related pod, to invade and or attack a third pod in order to steal food resources and females for breeding.
Wow. Yeah.
And this has only been reported in chimpanzees as far as exhibiting, quote-unquote, I hate to use the word warfare.
Right.
But as far as that kind of collusion, that kind of...
deep thinking.
That right. For another forward, species. Right. Yeah. Forward thinking, right. Plotting.
Strategizing.
Yeah. So, and this was, you know, once again, this was just recently reported. Right. And so, because we're getting a little bit better with technologies as far as radio collaring and tracking and understanding their behavior. And so, I think if we have the ability to keep studying these guys, I think they're just going to keep blowing our mind. They might take us over.
Yeah.
We could only be so lucky.
You know,
right?
It's like, you know, if anybody gets anything out of this podcast, it's animals aren't just stupid, instinctual animals.
No. Not at all.
Complex brain function.
Right. And so, you know, now, so switching gears and now looking at like the mother calf relationship. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm obviously biased. I'm a mom. Right. But they, you know, the mothers, they're mothering, they help teach, the babies have to learn how to echolocate. Mm-hmm. They're not just necessarily born with it. So they learn this from the mother. And so not only the mother, but the other females in the pod will help kind of steer the baby out of trouble until it gets better with echolocating. And they'll also, each female, this is great, Chris. Mm-hmm. It's been documented that females have different mothering styles.
Hmm.
Okay. Some are very protective.
Yeah.
While some are more relaxed in letting their calves explore,
right.
Which is just hilarious to me, or not hilarious, but it's so I can relate so much to this in the mothering community because I'm on all these mom face,
boards
mom social Facebook groups and whatnot. Yeah. And there's, you know, there's the helicopter mom and the tiger mom and the bear mom, and all these goofy titles, but it goes to show that there's some independent thinking there or they're learning from their own mom or maybe they're more experienced. So, you know, by the time you get a second and third kid, you just like let them do whatever. But I just think it's really fascinating to show, you know, that they're not stupid. They're thinking beings and they're planning and they're strategizing on how, you know, to quote unquote, be a good mom.
Right. Right.
And,
it's just, yeah, I mean, the animal world and the behavior. I know that's your jam, right? Evolution and genetics and stuff like that. But for you, when you talk behavior, you just light up. And when you look at these other species and you learn on how their social bonds and even an aquatic species is very, very difficult to study. And you find this stuff out. It just blows you away.
Right.
Because 100 years ago, you know, you go in and ask scientists and, you know, even go back to, say, Darwin in the 1800s, you know, animals are dumb.
Right.
Animals are here for our use. Animals are just, they're pretty to look at and for us to use and eat. They don't think because they don't build time machines. Mm-hmm. They don't build flying machines and, you know, stuff
it would
like
be
that.
Cool if they did.
Even if we built a time machine, right? But, you know, they haven't been to the moon or anything like that.
And well, I think, you know, just on their behalf too is so getting back a little bit to river dolphins, they use a series of clicks and pulses to vocalize, to communicate with each other. And the scientists are in the process, not with river dolphins, but with bottlenose dolphins, of trying to kind of
decipher.
Yeah, decipher. Yeah. There's a debate, you know, do they have a language or don't they?
Mm-hmm.
And some scientists say they do have a language and some say, oh, by our technical definitions, they don't. Right. And they don't form sentences. But they definitely use their different clicks and their different calls to communicate to mean potentially different things. And then interestingly enough, different pods have different vocalizations.
Some is dialects.
Mm-hmm. And then different individuals have different ones that evolve through their lifetime.
Here you go. Here's a cool study. Why don't we record the Amazon river dolphin speech, take it over to India and play it and see what happens.
Yeah, see if they understand it.
So that'd be a
or
cool
how they
study,
if they react to it.
Yeah, it'd be a cool study. Yeah.
Right.
And like, what language is this?
Yeah, and so I think there's just so much we have to learn. Right. I think that'll help kind of settle the debate, too, of how intelligent these animals are. And so with these clicks and these other vocalization or whistles, they're called, they also have a lot of non vocal communications too. So they do things like tail slaps, right, flipper slaps, blowhole noises, bubbles, which I think is just, yeah, that visual is super cute. Jaw claps and breeches as other ways to
communicate
right, with their buddies. And if you'll bear with me here, just because it's kind of my new fun thing that, yeah, I love to do.
No, I love it.
This is a sound of a bottlenose dolphin above the water, okay, right? Because remember, they're going to have some above water communication, right, like if you think of flipper, mm-hmm, or whatever, mm-hmm, and then they're going to have
underwater,
the underwater. So this is an above vocalization. And then now you can... I won't stop. And now, in contrast, this is going to be maybe a little bit muddied because it's underwater sounds, but this is a dolphin click and whistle. So you can hear the clicks. They're almost like...
It's a whole Morse code. Yeah.
Morse code. And there are some of the high...
The whistle. SOS, send more fish.
Mm-hmm.
SOS, send more fish.
So they definitely have a lot of things to say, and they definitely communicate with each other. I think it's more just going to be, over time, us learning exactly what that means.
Right, right. And kind of deciphering them. The... You know, then just quickly kind of going into echolocation and how that is used. It's really cool to read about their sonar. And that's what, mm-hmm, basically they're doing, is they send out these those noises,
mm-hmm,
and then they bounce back. So they have their biology through their nose and their large bulbous forehead, right?
There's a specialized organ in there, right?
So they send out the clicks. And then it comes back and they feel it in their jaws.
Mm-hmm.
And then that helps them echolocate, mm-hmm, and find fish and things that they want to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. Whales do this, right? Whales do that for hunting. Now, looking at dietary, I mean, pretty simple with the diets of the vaquitas and the marine environment, eating fish, some crustaceans, octopus, and then squid. Squid's a big thing in the Gulf of California.
Mm-hmm.
And interesting, they eat about 10% of their body weight per day. So about 10 to 15 pounds, depending on how big it is, which is a lot.
Seafood, yeah.
Same thing as river dolphins, eat about that per day. But being that they're in rivers, you know, they're more isolated to fish, some crabs.
And catfish, right. I read about.
And they even seen them eating small turtles.
Wow.
So they could eat that. And I bet you they eat some other things that we've never seen before. Maybe like eat some of those snakes down there.
Could train them for that.
Yeah. So again, what was interesting too is they have little hairs on their beaks.
Right, and that's one of the things that help. All mammals have to have hair.
Right, whiskers.
That's one of the classification things. Right. And so, yeah, a lot of them are born with whiskers and they fall off. Mm-hmm. But the river dolphins keep them?
Keep them, right, to help them feel.
Wow.
Right, feel, mm-hmm, the river bottoms and feeling for those fish and crabs and stuff. So another thing kind of that goes back to their intelligence is they're cooperative hunters.
Right.
So they hunt as a pod. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And again, planning, strategizing. Hey, you go over here. Right, right. And that kind of reminds me of like seeing those videos of, say, killer whales that breach themselves on, mm-hmm, beaches. I remember some of the, I think it's down in Argentina where they filmed a lot of this, or Chile. And the mom was showing the baby how to hunt,
mm-hmm,
and how, what channel she uses. And yeah, I mean, it's just, they're so smart.
Mm-hmm.
They're so smart. So doing some of that. Yeah. So basically, I mean, diet's pretty easy.
You know, they
eat fish, which you would think.
Right, they're carnivores.
Yeah, and other things in the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Or pescatarians or pescivores.
Whatever, yeah. So how do they make more baby dolphins?
Ah, well, this is very interesting. Well, first of all, they can't make baby dolphins. Males usually become about sexually mature between 8 to 12 years.
Wow, that's a long time.
So when we talk about life cycles, mm-hmm, and also increasing sustainable populations... They only give birth to one calf at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then if they're not, and if that calf doesn't become sexually mature, about 8 to 12 in a male and about 5 to 10 in a female.
It's a long interval.
So it's a while.
Yeah, it's a long interval.
It's a long interval before they can turn around and be reproductive again.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's a good segue into conservation with the vaquita, because, mm-hmm, that's really what we wanted to talk about.
Yes.
Today, and that's what kind of spurred this whole podcast.
Mm-hmm.
There are 30 left.
Yes.
Very controversial right now what's going on with them, because few aspects. One is being that we can't keep porpoises in captivity, which has been very difficult.
It's just been, it hasn't been as successful as the dolphins.
So that's been a worry. So I've read some quotes and some papers talking about don't mess with them. Mm-hmm. Just keep doing what the Mexican government's doing and hope they survive. So there's some views there. Like I said, debate and science. And that's what we kind of opened with, debate and science.
Well, and of course, that's what they had been doing
right.
for the past 5 years.
And it still hasn't helped.
And it hasn't helped. Yeah. The population is basically in from what they can tell, the counts in 2016 alone were cut in half. So there was about 60. Now there's about 30.
Right.
Basically, earlier this year in 2017, the Mexican government, bless their hearts, working with international groups, said, we've got to do something.
Right.
And we got to do something drastic. And we don't know if it's the right answer, but we know what we've been doing the last 5 years.
Hasn't worked.
Has not worked.
So that's a good answer. Yeah, so that's good. That's good.
And so what they've done is there's currently a proposal for a captive breeding program, which we know it's hard to keep porpoises in captivity, but a lot of our nationally recognized aquariums have scientists studying these things, and they've gotten much better at it. So right now the goal is to keep some in the wild, but also to capture some and move them to a captive setting where they can be safe.
Right.
And interestingly enough, there's a proposal right now that hasn't been done yet, but there's a proposal to use actually trained U.S. Navy dolphins
to
locate them.
Right.
And then, of course, the ones that are kept in the wild would be, monitored via satellite tag locators and whatnot. And they're really interesting thing, not only is the Mexican government and international kind of marine mammal community behind this, but I re-fell in love with one of my old crushes, Leonardo DiCaprio.
Is old a big crushes.
Yeah.
Poor John, sorry.
Hey, conservation crushes are okay in our family because he does a lot of good work. He does stuff for rhinos. Yeah, he does stuff for the environment and Africa water.
He does.
We
need more of that.
Exactly. If you're a celebrity, hey, all you celebrities out there,
use it.
If you, whether you're an athlete or a singer or an actor, people worship you. Show them how to give back to your community. And I would encourage you to be passionate about animals and wildlife. But if you're not, be passionate about another good cause.
Right.
There's tons of them out there, right? And get people excited. Get get people off the couch and off the social media and doing stuff. Anyways, that's my high horse for the minute. So Leonardo DiCaprio, and that little cute guy, is also backing this. But the biggest backer of them all is the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, or AZA. And they have so far pledged... so far has donated over $1 million. I think it's up to $1.2 million to helping to conserve this species and working with the Mexican government, addressing the conservation challenges. And then also they're going to help be this call to action and do whatever the Mexican government wants them to do as far as taking in some of these vaquitas to hopefully saving their population.
Part of my argument too on why we should do this. And when we say captive environment, they're going to be in large pens in the Gulf.
Correct.
So they're not going into a tank.
No.
Inland.
They're using research-based ways to help try to figure out the best way.
It's not wild, but they're in pens
that
are there to protect them.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing, I think the other reason a lot of probably the Mexican government was, of course, partnering with AZA is AZA has a history of doing this with other species in peril. The California condor, the golden lion tamarin out of Brazil, the black-footed ferret in Montana. So they have the expertise, and is it going to be perfect? No. But if we go another year without doing anything, there's going to be 10.
Yeah,
and then they're going to be in the same, within 2 years, they're going to be in the same plight as
northern whites.
Exactly.
Rhinos,
So I applaud AZA, and that kind of leads into one of my conservation organizations of the week.
Right.
If you have interest in helping the vaquita out, you can go to, aza.org/safe. That's SAFE. Vaquita Conservation.
Right.
SAFE stands for Saving Animals from Extinction. And there you can obviously become a member, and you could donate money, or even just like I said, even just becoming a member, you can get newsletters and learn more about what they're doing. They're very transparent with their action plans. Mm-hmm. And so you can see, Last I heard, they were working on starting this in the fall of 2017. Mm-hmm. So right now.
Right now.
So hopefully,
ready, yeah.
Hopefully they're out there on boats right now with looking their train. With how cool is that? With their trained, you know, Navy dolphins
yeah.
and helping these vaquitas out. And that's just a cool feel good story.
Yeah, and we'll put this in the show notes too. The links of all these.
Yeah, and my second organization of the week goes back to the River Dolphin, right. Which we were talking about earlier in this episode. And a really cool organization for that is called the U.S. Whale Organization. You can go to us.whales.org/riverdolphins. Mm-hmm. And there you can actually adopt
a river dolphin
or donate. And this is a really cool group that works with a lot of NGOs, so non-governmental groups in South America, especially for the river dolphins. And they hold workshops and they're working to stop illegal hunting, which we mentioned. Mm-hmm. And they also do a lot of on-the-ground work with local indigenous adults and children. And they're opening wildlife education centers throughout rural Amazonia.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
So, you know, the only way to save any species is to educate people.
Right.
And so if you start with the young people that matters the most to, there's your...
Right.
That's your only hope.
Right.
So I really applaud both of those organizations this week.
Yeah. And maybe for Christmas, you can get me a river dolphin.
I'm going to adopt.
Stuffy or something.
Dear family and friends out there, you will all be getting a river dolphin adoption. Absolutely. That's a great idea, though. Yeah, I mean, who wants another sock or spatula or,
toy that they're not going to live, use? My conservation tip of the week is water conservation. And I know I've kind of talked a little bit about this, about, you know, turning off the sink when you're not using it. Brushing your teeth, you know, turn it on and off. And I know we're kind of lazy and we just take it for granted. I have made a concerted effort to do that when I'm washing dishes or, like I said, if enough of us make an impact and conserve water, we can reduce, you know, by millions of gallons of water each year.
Absolutely.
And deal less with pollution, things going into, you know, sewer systems, things like that. And then also drawing away from our natural resources. Yeah. So, you know, me, myself, you know, how many gallons of water a week do I save? I don't know. But if most of us do it, thousands of us do
Sure, and it all starts at home. I have an almost 4-year-old at home that mimics everything we do. Mm-hmm. So he knows when he brushes his teeth, he shuts off the water.
Water, right.
That's not, it's not even a thing. And so the more it becomes ingrained in your, you know, natural
daily life.
Yeah.
Right.
The one I'm trying to work with him is sometimes he'll just go tinkle in the potty.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you don't need to flush that one. But of course at school.
If it's yellow, let it mellow. Is that the
My husband and I are totally hippies. We're like, whatever. You know, we barely flush.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but I think at school, of course, they flush there. So I got to keep the same message going.
Yeah.
But, you know, little things like that is it's important because I think water is going to be, when we talk about resources in the future.
Natural water, yeah.
That'll cause.
So maybe skip a shower. I can't. It's hard for me not to shower every day, but for some of you, maybe. Or take a quick shower one day a week.
Right.
Little things that we can do.
Well, and ladies too, I know we love to have our good looking hair, but honestly, the less you shampoo your hair, the better it ends
the
up
oils,
looking.
The natural oils.
I definitely don't have a problem with skipping showers.
My wife doesn't either.
Those that know me the best. Yeah, they're such a pain in the keister.
Were we talking about the MHC and smells last week?
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing is, you know, use reusable water bottles. Try your best to stop buying plastic water.
That's such a
dollar,
scam.
It is. $2 for a bottle of water.
Chris and I grew up in the 70s and 80s. Okay, I was late 70s, so I mostly grew up in the 80s. But we didn't have bottled water.
Yeah.
We didn't have plastic for water.
Right,
we didn't have plastic grocery bags.
No.
And if life was totally fine.
Yeah, we were.
It's probably better.
Yeah, it probably was. So there you go. There's your tips of the week. We're trying to, you know, and I think that has an influence on the oceans, right?
Absolutely.
All the garbage that's being dumped in the oceans.
Mm-hmm.
So it's every something we can all do with that. Now, final call for action. If you know somebody that loves animals, please share this podcast with them. Ask them to subscribe. Ask them to listen, learn, share. That's
comment,
our motto. Right.
Critique.
We want feedback.
Request
but
Request animals.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. You can go to our Patreon account, check that out. But please, if you know anybody, just say, hey, check out this podcast. We need to develop this community. We need to spread the word and we need to network together.
Yeah, let us do the, we'll do the groundwork
right,
for you.
Right, right. So again, thank you for listening.
Thank you, everyone.
Listen, learn, share. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.